This is KJZZ, your member-supported news and information station. I'm Catherine Fritke, and these are the stories you don't want to miss. For the week of May 29th, here are some top stories. First, here's KJZZ's Mark Brody.
Arizona Senator Jeff Flake today launched an initiative called NAFTA for AZ. He wants to gather personal stories from Arizonans whose lives have been positively impacted by the North American Free Trade Agreement. The Trump administration notified Congress earlier this month it plans to renegotiate NAFTA, but hasn't given a lot of detail about those plans. Flake hopes to use the feedback from NAFTA for AZ during the renegotiation process. And Senator Flake joins us now for a few minutes or more on that. Senator, good morning.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Well, thanks for being here. So what are you hoping to hear from Arizonans on this?
Well, I think Arizonans understand well that our relationship with Mexico and Canada, as expressed through NAFTA, this free trade agreement, has been good for us. It's been great for Mexico, great for Canada, and great for us. What I want to hear is personal stories from people and from businesses who have been positively affected by NAFTA. Often in campaigns, free trade agreements don't fare very well. We know that in reality, they're good for us.
Have you heard anything yet from folks? I know you just launched this, but I mean, have constituents reached out to you and said, hey, here's something we're concerned about?
We have. We received a lot of input over the past several months, concern about this talk of ripping up NAFTA first and then renegotiating it. Gratefully, I think the White House is now taking a more circumspect approach. They've said that they intend to renegotiate, but we hope that just involves modernizing NAFTA. It certainly can be modernized. There are provisions that were proposed in the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which would have included Mexico, that would have improved and modified or modernized NAFTA. We hope that's the direction we go. And yes, I've already heard this morning, and some people are already posting little videos on their experience with NAFTA.
Anything specific that you think would benefit Arizona in a renegotiation or maybe a modernization process?
Sure. In the 1990s, there wasn't as much focus on intellectual property, and that can be modernized and can be improved. So that could be helped. Also, the energy sector was generally left out of NAFTA. And there are provisions that can be put forward with regard to the energy sector that could benefit us and Mexico and Canada.
How much realistically do you think that the comments you get from Arizonans could impact the Trump administration in whatever it decides to do on NAFTA?
No, I think it can have a big impact. It's easier during a campaign for politicians to point to a shuttered factory and find a scapegoat, and it's usually free trade. When it is unseen, the benefits, it benefits a large number of people. Prior to NAFTA, our total trade with Mexico, for example, was less than $60 billion a year. Now it's approaching $600 billion a year. And that benefits our entire country, but certainly Arizona, having close proximity and sharing a border with Mexico, benefits even more.
Senator, before I let you go, if I might ask you about another international agreement that's been in the news. The Trump administration is talking about what it's going to do with the Paris Climate Agreement. The president has apparently said that he's leaning maybe toward withdrawing the U.S. from that deal. What do you think of that decision?
Well, I think it's certainly appropriate to review these agreements that we've entered into, just like free trade agreements. I think with regard to free trade agreements, we generally find that they've been good for everyone. It's not a zero-sum game. With the Paris agreements, my understanding is that we kind of set our own targets within it. And so it's some people's opinion that we ought to stay within it, but change the targets or recognize that we are in control of the targets we set over time. And I certainly think that we have to guard our own sovereignty and make sure that we aren't shouldering all the burden that needs to be shouldered with regard to climate change. But I think that this review process that we're entering into will be helpful in that regard.
Arizona Senator Jeff Flake. Senator Flake, thanks a lot for your time.
Thanks for having me on.
And now from KJZZ's The Show, let's talk about cultural appropriations. Here's the show's Lauren Gilger.
We hear it a lot whenever a hipster chef opens up a new take on Asian cuisine or a white person opens up a taco shop. People scream cultural appropriation. You can't steal another culture's cuisine and sell it as your own. That's what happened after two white women opened up a pop-up breakfast burrito concept in Portland recently called Kook's Burritos. They told Willamette Week that they got the idea after traveling to Baja California, falling in love with the fresh handmade tortillas there, and picking the brains of Mexican women in the region to find out how to make them. They were quickly attacked for cultural appropriation or using another culture's traditions or language without permission. They ended up shutting down their shop. But Gustavo Arellano says this is laughable. He's the publisher and editor of the OC Weekly and the author of their Ask a Mexican column. He wrote a piece about the skirmish in Portland recently, and I spoke with him more about why he thinks we should all let white people appropriate Mexican food.
Frankly, it boils down to this. Cultural appropriation is such a big issue in just, you know, in American society right now, but especially when it comes to food, this idea that minorities always have their food stolen by white people especially white people, and that they're eternally victims and, oh, woe is them, and let's talk trash on the people who do the appropriating.
Right.
And I as a food critic, I mean, I do my Ask a Mexican column, yes, but I've been the food critic OC Weekly for 15 years. So I've been covering this stuff forever. And I just got sick of it. I said, no, we're not victims. We're Mexicans, we're humans. And more importantly, Mexicans rip off like no other culture when it comes to food. And that's why Mexican food is the best food in the world, because we rip it off from everyone.
Give us a couple of examples of that.
Oh, geez. Let's see. All that great Mexican beer that people love, Tecates, maybe not Corona, but Indio, Bohemia, they're all German beers, Czech beers, Austrian beers, Pilsners. You see the Tecate can, it's an Austrian heraldic eagle right there. Al Pastor came from Lebanese immigrants. I mean, it's shawarma, except with pork. Tequila came from the Spaniards. Basically, anything that walks on four legs except deer comes from the Spaniards that we eat. The cows, the beef, the pork, the goat. Of course, you can't forget the goat. All the pan dulces that we like, those nice little dessert breads, they're all French breads. And onward and onward and onward it goes. That's what mestizaje, this idea of Mexico as a blend of cultures is. It's about taking food and taking customs from another culture and adding it onto your own and getting, creating a better product.
Right, but you think there's really nothing wrong with that either, like in that making Mexicans or whatever culture may be appropriated in whatever example, the victim is sort of patronizing.
It is absolutely patronizing. Again, I am not saying that Mexicans are not victims. Oh, we've been harassed forever, especially down there in Maricopa County for many, many years. However, a victim to me is someone who gets victimized and doesn't do anything about it. And that's not Mexicans. We fight back. We fight back one way or another. And especially when it comes to food. And this is one thing especially that a lot of the people who have these arguments against cultural appropriation don't understand. They're not in the restaurant industry. They are not restaurateurs, or they don't cover restaurateurs or restaurants for a living. If they did, they would know that in being in the restaurant business, it is the most Darwinian, one of the most Darwinian businesses possible. It's where everyone rips everyone off, and the only privilege that anyone has is how smart are you to be able to rip someone else off before anyone else rips you off.
So does this only apply to the food industry, or does this go elsewhere?
Well, my comments specifically were about food. Now you could get to other ideas of cultural appropriation, like Dia de los Muertos, like, religion, the use of iconography, like the Virgen de Guadalupe. Of course, the thing that bugs me is just the preponderance now of everyone into Dia de los Muertos insignias, the skulls and all that. And I don't have a problem with people thinking that's cool, but the question I always have is, who makes it cool? Mm-hmm. It is not the general white population does it. And frankly, if you want to blame anyone for cultural appropriation, blame us in the media, who are too lazy to try to find actual stories until a white person or some, not just white person, until that, you know, influencer, as they call them now, that influencer who gets all cool. And then we start highlighting them as saying, oh, look, you've created this or you've discovered this new trend. That is Columbusing. Columbusing I have a huge problem with. Mm-hmm. But appropriation, those, you know, it's like comparing not apple and oranges, let's say burritos and quesadillas.
Right. right. So I wonder, do you think there's a difference then between white people appropriating Mexican culture and the other way around, Mexican people sort of appropriating food from Europe or the Caribbean or wherever? I wonder, like, if this is based on a power structure, is that really considered appropriation if it goes the other way around?
Well, you see, Mexicans get a pass because Mexicans, again, we're poor perpetual peons forever. And so we could do anything we want. And white people, they're the evil wasichu. They are just try to steal everything and anything. It's silly. You see how silly that sounds? It's just preposterous. Hey, we want to talk about appropriation. You guys have it in Arizona, but it's specifically in Tucson. The Sonoran dog. No one, I don't hear Americans crying about, oh, how Mexicans stole our bacon-wrapped hot dogs. I don't hear Oscar Mayer complaining about that. No, because everyone's mouth are stuffed with Sonoran dogs. But here's a funny thing. In California, in Southern California, we don't call them Sonoran dogs. We call them TJ dogs for Tijuana, the nickname for Tijuana. And so people think that those hot dogs came from Tijuana. What they don't realize is that Mexicans in Southern California, we ripped them off from Mexicans in Tijuana, who ripped them off from Mexicans in Tucson, who ripped them off from Mexicans in Sonora. But since it's Mexicans doing it, somehow it's okay. Either it's all bad or it's none or none of it's bad. And I choose the latter.
So you don't think any of this is bad?
No, I will say this. When you start bragging about it, and that's one of the things that the two white girls up in Portland did, they started like boasting, yeah, you know, we went from this stall to that stall. That's just bad manners. And again, it is a little bit hypocritical, but if you're going to try to go around and try to cook a cuisine that's not yours, at least own up to it. Just say, hey, you know what? I really love this food. It was really amazing. I saw an opportunity where I live and I decided to try to do it instead of saying, yeah, we're going to do it better than those Mexicans. No, you're not going to do it better than the Mexicans. These women have decades of experience doing it, coming from a culture that has been doing it from centuries. You're a couple of white girls up in Portland who look like, you know, you look like 2 days out of Coachella. So no, you're not going to do it better.
Gustavo Arellano is the publisher and editor of the OC Weekly and the author of their Ask a Mexican column.
You're listening to the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast. From the Fronteras Desk, research shows Latino immigrants enjoy good health when they first get to the United States. But over time and generations, they become prone to obesity. From the Fronteras Desk in Phoenix, KJZZ's Matthew Casey reports on efforts to give Maryvale residents better access to affordable, fresh produce.
Catherine Hall stuffs a Ziploc bag full of mixed salad greens. She works at Fresh Express, a mobile produce store built into an old Green City bus.
We like to pack them really good.
Fresh Express has been around the valley for years, but only recently started making regular trips to Maryvale.
Oh, and they're organic too, by the way.
Fresh Express is parked outside Golden Gate Community and Health Center, which traces its roots back decades to the barrios displaced by the airport. Latino women dressed in workout clothes leave the center and walk to their cars. Some look curiously at the idling bus, but then keep moving. Finally, one comes over. The woman was looking for a particular kind of squash. Hall shows her yellow and spaghetti squash, but the woman leaves without buying anything.
We know that it's about diving into the community and addressing what the community's needs are.
Monica Snyder is the head of clinical operations for Mercy Maricopa Integrated Care. The nonprofit is part of a coalition behind Fresh Express and other efforts to change Maryvale's status as a so-called food desert, which is a place with little or no access to healthy food. Data show more than 20% of Latino children and more than 40% of adults are obese.
And when we decided that we were going to provide community reinvestment dollars to fund these initiatives, we wanted to be in a community that was ready to receive the help, and Maryvale is that community.
About 140,000 undocumented immigrants live in Phoenix. In the 1980s, a demographic shift transformed Maryvale into a predominantly Latino neighborhood with lots of newly arrived immigrants. Dr. Sandra Albrecht studies immigrant nutrition at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. She says there's a couple reasons why most Latinos have good health when they get here.
People that are willing and able to migrate tend to be just physically healthier, mentally healthier, to be able to withstand the rigors of a migration process.
It also depends on where people came from.
Some of these countries tend to still have healthier dietary patterns, and they have less of a sedentary lifestyle than the U.S.
This changes over time, though.
The longer an immigrant lives in the U.S., the greater the likelihood they are of becoming obese and just as obese as the U.S. born.
But, Albrecht says, this doesn't mean the United States causes immigrants to become obese, which is why she wants to study if there's a link between assimilation and declining health, or if it can be traced back to where people came from.
Because of things like the obesity epidemic in Mexico and in many of these countries of origin, we're seeing more and more that immigrants are losing their health advantage.
If obesity is connected to assimilation, the one solution? Maryvale's kids. A class of third graders literally planted the seeds of another coalition-backed project to improve nutrition. They started a community garden.
Right here we have tomatoes.
Ignacio Murillo is 9 years old. He wears a school uniform and shows me around.
I think that's like lettuce.
Teacher Sarah Isaac.
Every day we check on the plants, make sure they're getting enough water, adjust the drip system if we need to.
The garden sprouted from a discussion on how Isaac students could make a difference.
You can't really teach empathy, and I found that all of my students are very empathetic. They're very concerned about people around them.
Isaac says all of her students either get free or reduced lunch. Experts say poverty has a big impact on nutrition.
They were very honest. We don't have a lot of vegetables at home, and we don't have a lot of fruits.
The coalition has pitched in on the class project and started other gardens in Maryvale. Monica Snyder with Mercy Maricopa Integrated Care says the key now is to educate and engage residents.
So we don't have gardens that were thriving year one, but in year two are nothing more than just a placeholder.
Snyder hopes this will cause a change in how Maryvale residents think about affordable fresh food and where to get it in the next 8 months. Matthew Casey, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
In education news, it's the end of the school year, and one first-year teacher has managed school, work, and family life full-time, and learned what it takes to manage a classroom along the way. In our latest installment of the series, Inside Arizona Classrooms, KJZZ's Casey Kuhn explains how the education workforce is changing to accommodate more teachers like her.
Second graders, soon to be third graders, sit quietly working at their desks in Tracy Irvin's classroom at Desert Oasis Elementary.
Really quickly, tomorrow.
It's a stark contrast to the first time I visited Irvin's classroom as she began her first year full-time teaching at the district. Students had trouble sitting still during a group reading.
So, boys and girls, it's my turn to speak.
Irvin says she's come a long way in this first year.
Well, when I first started, I had no idea what I was doing. I didn't know how this was going to look, how the kids were going to respond, how my technique was going to engage the learner.
And now she's got the students under control, using techniques like singing songs at the end of the day.
Once you learn how to manage the classroom, everything else will come together, but it's really hard trying to learn how to manage the classroom.
She says she expected a more traditional setup, like instructing a group of students, sitting quietly, and adjusting to the teacher. Now, she says, she adjusts to the kids. But getting to that point was no easy task.
There were times this year that I said, I don't know if I'm coming back, because it was very difficult. It was very stressful at times trying to figure out, okay, how can I get to this learner? How can I really get this child to produce?
Irvin's first year was stressful because she's also going to school full-time to get her teaching certificate. Her district was able to hire her with that program to fill needed teacher positions. It's one way a lot of schools are getting around what some are calling a teacher shortage.
When we get an application, we're calling that individual within minutes.
Justin Wing is head of human resources for the largest elementary school district in Arizona, Washington Elementary.
Every day is a recruiting day. We still have about 51 teacher vacancies with little to no applicant pool to speak of.
Wing also surveys schools statewide, and he says teacher vacancies keep going up across the board. In an attempt to address those empty positions, Governor Doug Ducey recently signed a bill to let schools hire someone without formal training for teacher positions. Since passed, Wing says they've had one or two applicants with those type of qualifications. The bill has been met with mixed reactions, says Arizona School Administrator Association Director Mark Jorenstad.
A lot of people feel the new law harms the professionalism of teaching as a whole and making the standards lower.
Jorenstad says the rigors of teaching require more than just expertise in a field.
Getting along with students, while at the same time keeping a classroom under positive control is really a challenging skill.
Jorenstad sees the new law as a short-term solution. But Arizona State University Teaching College Dean Carol Basile says there may not be a solution to the teacher shortage. Rather, the workforce itself is evolving.
I'm not sure that this workforce is going to come back in the same way that it always has. I'm not convinced of that.
She says the field used to be predominantly women, but now women are finding other higher paying jobs. And she says changing the teaching field will require a change of mindset, something other than just, you're a teacher, so teach everything from math to art to this class full of random children.
We've got to start to think about this differently, and we have to. It's not a workforce shortage issue, it's a workforce issue.
Back at Desert Oasis, first-year teacher Tracy Irvin still has another year of school to go before she has her teacher certificate. And she says she's thought about throwing in the towel, but she feels something tethering her to the classroom.
And that's the part about teaching. It's, although it's stressful, although you're ready to sometimes say, I can't do this, it's too much, it's something that's still an inner voice that's saying, no, keep going, keep fighting.
That passion for teaching is what many schools are still hoping to find in bringing more teachers into the classroom. Casey Kuhn, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
In a check of business news, lobbyists who break the rules in Phoenix could soon face prosecution. From the KJZZ Business Desk, Christina Estes reports the City Council unanimously approved a tougher ordinance.
Lobbyists get paid to influence decisions on things like zoning issues, incentives for developers, and multi-million dollar contracts for goods and services. They're required to register with the city and disclose gifts to city officials. But current law has no language detailing how to punish those who ignore the rules. That will change July 1st, when lobbyists who violate the ordinance will be warned and given 15 days to register. Repeat offenders could face fines and possible jail time. Christina Estes, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
And finally, this week in the world of science, researchers have completed the first full genome map of the Mojave Desert tortoise. They hope the data will aid conservation of the threatened species. From the Arizona Science Desk, KJZZ's Nicholas Gerbis reports.
There's a lot we'd like to know about the Mojave Desert tortoise. How does it cope with heat, ultraviolet radiation, and disease? When did it branch off from the Sonoran Desert tortoise? How does it live and reproduce for 50-plus years? Study author Kendra Kasumi with Arizona State University says a full genome could provide answers and offer clues as to how the species adapts to invasive plants and shifting climates.
We don't really know where the sort of the genetic, you know, treasure in the gold mine is. You know, where is that, like, the diversity that would allow, you know, the tortoise species, you know, as a species to survive changes?
The May 31st PLOS One study found gene changes affecting shell growth, the immune system, longevity, circadian rhythm, and water conservation. Nicholas Gerbis, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
This has been the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast, made possible in part by Vitalist Health Foundation, the IEEE Foundation, the Arizona Community Foundation, ASU Research, Alliance Bank of Arizona, Beach Fleischman, the Arizona Community Foundation, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Thank you for listening to KJZZ and for your generous support. I'm Catherine Fritke, and this is KJZZ, your news and information source.